We're getting into the gory details of becoming king in this chapter, the next chapter, which some of you might find interesting, some of you might find a little grossed out, but you know, oh well. Won't make excuses, that's the name of the Bible, it's how God works, how people are. So this is 2 Samuel chapter 2.
In the course of time, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up to the one of the towns of Judah?" He asked. The Lord said, "Go up." David asked, "Where shall I go?" "To Hebron," the Lord answered. So David went up there with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. David also took the men who were with him, each with his family, and they settled in Hebron and his towns. Then the men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. When David was told that it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who had buried Saul, he sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead to say to them, "The Lord bless you for showing this kindness to Saul your master by burying him. May the Lord now show you kindness and faithfulness, and I too will show you the same favor because you have done this. Now then, be strong and brave, for Saul your master is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." Meanwhile, Abner son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. He made him king over Gilead, Asheri, and Jezreel, and also over Ephraim, Benjamin, and Israel. Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. The length of time David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Abner, son of Ner, together with the men of Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, left Mahanaim and went to Gibeon. Joab, son of Zeruiah, and David's men went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. One group sat down on one side of the pool and one group on the other side. Then Abner said to Joab, "Let's have some of the young men get up and fight hand to hand in front of us." "All right, let them do it," Joab said. They stood up and were counted off, 12 men for Benjamin and Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, and 12 for David. And each man grabbed his opponent by the head and thrust his dagger into his opponent's sides, and they fell down together. So that place in Gibeon was called Hilkath Hazarim. The battle that day was very fierce, and Abner and the men of Israel were defeated by David's men. The three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Now Asahel was fleet-footed as a wild gazelle. He chased Abner, neither turning to the right nor to the left as he pursued him. Abner looked behind him and asked, "Is that you, Asahel?" "It is," he answered. Then Abner said to him, "Turn aside to the right or to the left, take on one of the young men and strip him of his weapons." But Asahel could not stop chasing him. Again, Abner warned Asahel, "Stop chasing me. Why should I strike you down? How could I look your brother Joab in the face?" But Asahel refused to give up the pursuit. So Abner thrust the butt of his spear into Asahel's stomach, and the spear came out through his back. He fell there and died on the spot. And every man stopped when he came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner. As the sun was setting, they came to the hill of Ammah, near Gia, on the way to the wasteland of Gibeon. Then the men of Benjamin rallied behind Abner. They formed themselves into a group and took their stand on top of a hill. Abner called out to Joab, "Must the sword devour forever? Don't you realize that this will end in bitterness? How long before you order your men to stop pursuing their brothers?" Joab answered, "As surely as God lives, if you had not spoken, the men would have continued the pursuit of their brothers until morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men came to a halt. They no longer pursued Israel, nor did they fight any more. All that night, Abner and his men marched through the Arabah. They crossed the Jordan, continued through the whole Bithron, and came to Mahanaim. Then Joab returned from pursuing Abner and assembled all his men. Besides Asahel, 19 of David's men were found missing. But David's men had killed 360 Benjamites who were with Abner. They took Asahel and buried him in his father's tomb at Bethlehem. Then Joab and his men marched all night and arrived at Hebron by daybreak.
Any comments, questions about this particular chapter? It seems relatively gory, in that you have, obviously, the battle starts out with 24 men killing each other, and it continues on throughout, obviously, that day, and quite a few die from both sides, but particularly from Abner's side. Any issues, questions? Nothing? Okay. Well, that makes life simpler. Let's see, we had 360 men die from Abner's side versus, well, 19 plus 1, so Asahel is also 1. So 20 die from David's side. Yes, Ellie, you had a comment here.
Well, I have a question. In verse 14, Abner says to Joab, now these two guys are not on speaking terms, right?
Abner
and Joab? They're fighting against one another.
We're going to discuss the relationship in a little more detail, but Abner was Saul's general.
Right.
And Joab was David's general.
Yeah. So
and Joab,
enemies.
They, for the most part, they didn't interact typically
and
at all.
So they decide, oh, well, let's just let the young men fight it out. I mean, it's like
a
game. I mean,
if
the two of them can sit down from different sides and come to a conclusion to let them fight it out, why don't they just say, hey, you know what, maybe it's time to stop. My guy's dead.
Mm-hmm. You'd think so, huh?
You'd think. Odd.
We're going to discuss a little bit about these individuals, what they're likely thinking at this time based on their actions, what's going on. We're trying to get inside their heads just a little bit. Not that it's not easy, because they died a long time ago. But we're going to try to do that. Why would they even suggest such a thing? Why dueling? Well, what's the purpose of that? Does that accomplish anything at all? One wants to be king? Possibly. One might want to be king. We'll get to explore a little bit more in the coming chapter or two. First of all, who are these men? Now, we discussed Abner, son of Ner. He is Saul's general. He was responsible for all of Saul's, not responsible, partly responsible, for all of Saul's victories going out in battle. When Saul and his core sons die, Abner is the one who goes out, finds Ishbosheth, and says he is the rightful heir and establishes him as king. Over, of course, everybody else other than the tribe of Judah. Who are the three brothers, son of Zeruiah, on David's side? Who are these men? How old are they? Their age is key here. Does anybody know who Zeruiah is? How many brothers did David have? Six. He was the seventh one. They had six brothers. How many sisters did David have? Two. There were two sisters. Abigail was one of his sisters. Zeruiah was the other. David was the youngest of his family. So he has two older sisters. The sons of Zeruiah are his three nephews. Zeruiah is female. She's the mom. Sorry, Zeruiah is his sister. It's unusual. These three men are being addressed by the sons of their mother as opposed to their father, which is unusual, but that's what's actually happening here. These are his nephews. David becomes king at 30. He's the youngest of his brothers and sisters, because he's the youngest of his whole family. These men, most likely, based on just typical families, are younger than David, probably in their mid-20s. Because if David just reached 30, he was probably born before them, most likely. And these three sons, these three brothers, would be born, might likely, younger than him. Yes, Bill.
Is that partly a foreshadowing of Messiah?
That's possible. I didn't think about that. I don't think I have a good answer for that one. I don't know. I haven't tried to figure out why he's being associated as their mom. The common belief is, since David's writing this, and he curses Joab's father's line, not his sister, for something that Yoab does shortly in a few chapters from here, that he likes his sister. So he addresses his family as, this is my family. I don't care who your dad is. This is my family. These are my relatives. These are my nephews who are in charge. Are they very good at what they do? Well, yeah, they're the generals. There's a reason you get to that ranking is because you're very talented at killing and coordinating military people. So that's who these guys are. They're young. How many generals do you know are in the 20s? Yeah, we all laugh. That's a joke. There are generals in their 20s. You're the bottom end of nobody at that age. It takes years and years of experience. Now, how old do you think Abner is? Now, Abner was the general when David was a very young man. Abner has been in charge of Saul's army from the beginning. Abner, David being young, most likely about 20 or so when he killed Goliath, Abner was already general then, and this is 10 years later, Abner's still general. He's probably at least since he commands in that chapter, he overpowers Ishbosheth, who's in his 40s. Abner's probably in his 50s or so. A much wiser, easier, or smarter person to be able to manipulate a younger, inexperienced individual. So Abner is actually a very intelligent individual at this point.
One of my favorite sayings is old age treachery
defeat,
use and skill every time.
Yes, old age and treachery defeat.
So you probably fail, think,
and grip. Well, we're going to discuss Abner's technique and why he did what he did. Yes, Tammy.
I think about this son of Saul here. He's the fourth one. Jonathan was obviously the one Saul had worked really hard to prepare for the job to rule.
Yep.
And he may have done something with the other two sons that also died.
Right.
But I can't imagine that he would have done much of any training of this particular son.
Most likely he did not. And there's actually a key to that as to what Saul, or how Saul likely felt or thought about this particular son, this fourth one. Was he named Ishbosheth when he was born? Son of my disgrace. Would you name your son son of my disgrace? Chronicles records his name as Ishbaal. Son of my strength. Or son of my foreign strength. Because who usually names the children? The one who gave birth to them. It's an odd thing as to what would make a man rename or alter his son's name from my strength to my shame, to my regret, to my disdain. No, this is not no crippling at all. And this, that was a different individual. I forgot his name off the top of my head. We'll discuss that shortly. Yeah, that's right. He's like a 5 or 6 year old little kid at this point. Yes, Ellie.
You wouldn't alter it. Other people would alter it.
Possibly others would alter it. It's been argued that because he was never mentioned up until this point, that maybe he was just a younger son. The youngest of all of them, possibly. Well, if he's in his 40s, his other sons would be in their probably upper 40s or so, and that could happen. The other possibility, which is not widely accepted, but still possible, he's not the son of Saul's wife. But rather, Jonathan was, and all of Jonathan's two brothers. They're the ones, the rightful heirs to the king, to the throne. The reason that's believed is because Ishbosheth rules for 2 years, and David rules for 7.5 in Hebron. So what's happening with the other tribes? Who are they obeying for the missing 5.5 years? They're not obeying or following Ishbosheth. They're not obeying or following David. What would make them not want to follow Ishbosheth? It's possible they didn't think he was rightful king. Possible. What would make them not want to follow David? Because of all the stuff that they know what David has done and they were told about him and various things, which Abner was responsible for. So there are potential issues that we don't know a lot about Ishbosheth, but we know that he got his name changed. One, who changed it, we don't know for sure, but his name was changed. He is 40 years old, obviously. He only rules for 2 years, and he's killed. So something happens to either kill him. Immediately once, by the way, when he dies, David becomes king of everything. So you do the math. That means the first 5.5 years, David's king of Hebron, and the northern tribes have no king. They don't follow, they don't obey, they don't follow along with Ishbosheth. They don't accept him as king. Until the last 2 years, because Abner is a very forceful personality. And we'll read more about him as far as what he's capable of and what he did and how he coerced the other tribes to follow and obey Ishbosheth for only 2 years. And Ishbosheth gets slaughtered by his own men anyway, so he's not really that well respected to start with. So it's possible one of two ways. He was just the youngest son. Saul didn't care. Or he was possibly a son of a different wife. We don't know. I won't go beyond that as far as his identity. Oh, yes, Tammy?
Well, so far as we know, David was the son of the same wife as all the other kids were, and they didn't seem to care about him too much either. Until Samuel basically said...
He's the one selected.
Yeah.
He was the youngest guy. He doesn't mean a whole lot. So it's equally possible. He just could have just young. That's what he mentioned. One or two ways. He could be just the youngest guy. If he, oh, well, he's never going to be king because he's the youngest. It could be easy that way. We don't know for sure. Why his name got changed is kind of curiosity more than anything else. Okay. Let's go back a little bit here. So after the death of Saul, David has no enemies left in Israel as far as he's concerned. Because Saul was his primary enemy. Jonathan, or Jehonatan, was supposed to be his assistant. Of course, now is dead. Does David fear Ishbosheth? Does David even know Ishbosheth? Yeah, maybe. Can't say they actually really met. We know much about them. David didn't spend a whole lot of time in Saul's house. Maybe he was there for his wedding. It's probably not the extent that they may have met each other. Does he have reason to believe that Ishbosheth wants him dead? Does David have any reason to believe that Ishbosheth doesn't like him, and Ishbosheth desires his demise, much like Saul did? In particular, as a result, what does David do? David doesn't know. Maybe Ishbosheth wants him dead. What does he do then? What's his first act after he grieves and says, okay, Saul and Jonathan are dead? What's the first thing he does? Well, verse 1, it says, he asks God, shall I go up to the cities of Judah? Because God could have said no. Maybe, David doesn't know God's plan, maybe God's plan was to lead Ishbosheth as the next king. And David had to wait. He didn't know. He didn't know what the result was. What if he went up to Judah and one of the cities, and then all the armies came and Ishbosheth and destroyed David? He doesn't know. He doesn't know what God's plan is. Of course, the audience answered, yes. Okay, well, which city do I go up to? God chooses Hebron. So the first thing David does is he asks God, I know you already anointed me king. I know what I'm supposed to do eventually. Is this the timing, or must I wait further?
To me, almost implies that there is some time that has passed before David inquires of the Lord.
The wording is, it happened after this
okay.
time.
Mine says in the course of time, but... Okay.
Yeah, the common interpretation, maybe I'm wrong, is that it's referring to after the grieving of Saul and Jonathan, however long that took. Right now, we don't know how much time passed. It could have been. Maybe those 5.5 years were this gap. We don't know. It could be years later. It could be days later. One of the common beliefs is that David needs to leave before the Philistines return from the battle. Because now David is going to move on to the king. There's nothing to stop them and say, okay, David, no, we're going to kill you now before you become king of Israel so we can dominate all of it. Because now, right now, the Philistines only dominate the Jezreel Valley area, and Manasseh and part of Ephraim. That's it. That's where the battle took place. This is where the people left, and they fled. Did the Philistines come down to Judah? No, they're up here. This is where the army is. Why did they not go to Judah yet? Because Judah's a whole lot stronger than these people up here were. Philistines had heavy casualties too. So they can't just immediately come down here. But if they want to conquer Judah, the next thing they got to do, kill David who's in Ziklag. Because he's the next king of Judah. So it's believed that David's desire is to leave the Philistine-controlled territory as quickly as possible. Hence, it would be a short period of time after the battle. But it could be the exact opposite. Maybe David had no fear of the Philistines. Maybe they all returned home. It had been years later, and David's finally saying, okay, now it's time to go. We don't know. We don't know how much time passed. The common belief is that it's a short period of time. A few days, possibly a week, hard to say for certain. So he goes with his wives. He doesn't have any children yet, by the way, just wives, because the children are born in Hebron. He goes with his men, they go to Hebron. Why would God choose Hebron? Why didn't God choose Bethlehem like David's hometown? Bethlehem's not buried in Hebron. Who's buried in Hebron? The matriarchs and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not all the matriarchs, one's not there, but the rest of them are. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are in Hebron. Does God hold Hebron in some unique status as a result? What is that status? Of that was illegally owned. Legally owned. And Abraham now is dwelt, of course, is buried, all those bones are there. So why would God want David to go to Hebron? What does that mean? Is it symbolic of something? No, not a beginning. Think of who the patriarchs and matriarchs are. What were they known for and why they're buried there? Say it again. Believing God. Abraham, we know that. He believed God. He's God's friend. Who else is buried there? Isaac. What's Isaac known for? Fearing God. What's Jacob known for? Jacob. He's buried there as well. Simplicity. Commonly known for as loving God, in spite of the difficulties he went through. Israel struggles with God. So what purpose is God trying to tell or describe to telling David to go to Hebron? Yeah. He's continuing that pattern. He's continuing the selection process. Yes, Ellie.
Because the tabernacle of David is all 12 tribes together. And that's where the 12 tribes, that's where Israel is buried. And he is the father of the 12 tribes.
Yes.
So this is the first time this has happened under David, that he's reuniting that.
He's reuniting under that identity. He's saying this banner that consists of God, of selecting these individual men, God went through the process of selecting them one at a time. You're with Esau and Jacob. You had Isaac and, what's his name? Ishmael. Thank you. God selected. Oh, yes, technically, this person should be rightful, but God said, no, I'm choosing this one. This one should be next. No, I'm choosing this one. This one should be next with David, his older brothers. I mean, no, I'm choosing this one. It's a selection process. God's identifying, I have chosen him, and David's reconnecting, by God selecting Hebron, reconnecting that identity. God could have easily sent David home. Go to Bethlehem, where your family is, where your property is, where your identity is. Bring your brothers, your sisters, all your sons, bring them back home where they couldn't live for the past couple of years. But he didn't. He said, no, you're going to go to Hebron instead. You're going to establish a kingdom there based on my selection process. Because I chose you. David's identifying himself as being a chosen one. Correction. God's identifying David as being chosen. David didn't do anything. He just obeyed. Didn't mean to misspeak. So, of course, David goes there. He goes, which also, by the way, Hebrew also means sojourner, which has another symbolic meaning. I'm not going to go too much detail into that one. He goes there, of course. It's told him, the men of Jabesh Gilead helped Saul. Of course, David's had full respect for Saul in spite of the desire for Saul to kill him. He sends messengers from Hebron, or basically from Judah, don't know exactly which city they're from, to be Jabesh Gilead, saying, hey, yes, you did something good. I will deal with you just equally as well. He's identifying to them, I hold no remorse for Saul. Anybody who helps him, I have no remorse for them. No anger toward them. Sorry, not, wrong word. No remorse. No anger toward Saul. No anger to anybody who helps him. I have remorse for Saul and the loss for him. That's all. He's identifying that I still support you. What you did was good in my eyes. They have nothing to fear, which they have reason to believe that maybe they should. I mean, David and Saul were enemies. Maybe they'll be held responsible in David's eyes for trying to help Saul to do what they thought was right. He's identifying, no, you did what was right. You did follow what God would have wanted, what I wanted. So he's trying to reach out, so to speak. What I also want to point out is, where is Ishbosheth? Where did Abner bring him to? Mahanaim. It's over across the Jordan in the Gilead territory. Who named Mahanaim? Anybody remember? What does that name mean? Somebody know, recall what that name means? I'm is plural. Maha, hosts or camp. Plural camps. Who had his tribe cut in half? Before Manasseh. Long before Manasseh. Jacob. Jacob, when he's returning to Canaan, he says, I have now become two camps. And he named that place because he said, God is here at this camp. I will divide myself in two here. So it's actually the Lord's two camp. It's a more accurate statement of Mahanaim. As God has divided me into two. So Ishbosheth, going to Mahanaim, is symbolic of what? Two camps. God dividing the camps into two. One more thing about Mahanaim. What's going to happen? Where does David flee to when Absalom is taking control? Mahanaim. God's dividing the camp into two. It's symbolic. Mahanaim happens to be a wonderfully built natural fortress. Unfortunately, it does get destroyed when the Babylonian kings come and take over, but yeah, oh wow, that does happen over life. Ishbosheth goes there because God has divided the town or the company or the country or their world, their tribes, into two groups. The king down here and the kings up there. He split them up. Now it's David's job to reunite them. Yes.
It was interesting because I always had it in my mind that Benjamin was always allied with Judah. But here we see
they're not.
That no, they're not.
They're not. Yeah, we associate that because we think, oh, lost 10 tribes. Oh, because Judah and Benjamin are all together, right? So everybody else is lost, but they're found. Well, that's not actually accurate. Eventually the border becomes and incorporates most of Benjamin, but not all of it. Parts of Benjamin stays up north, even when the company is split into this Rehoboam. I think they did both the countries split. Part of Benjamin goes south, part of Benjamin goes north. Depends which part that liked who. I never liked the lost 10 tribes because I think, well, what about Simeon? He's dwelling down here inside of Judah, but I never grasped that. So to me, it's like, okay, something's a little missing. And Levi is scattered all amongst, so really feel like the lost 9. Because there's only, I don't know, we're not going to go into too much detail. But it's been a confusing thing for me to see lost 10. But anyway, so it's symbolic of God dividing the kingdom up. Well, it's David's job to say, hey, I'm reaching out to Yabesh Gilead, which of course Mahanaim is part of. I want to reconnect. I desire a connection. I desire a reattachment. To reunite the country again, under me, under the Messiah. What's the Messiah supposed to do? To reunite all the tribes again, under a single roof, a single king. And the process of the selection. God selected him. So it's Messiah's job to reunite. Yes, Ellie.
On the issue of the lost 9 and the lost 10, there are 10 because Manasseh and Ephraim are two of them. So you can leave 3 behind and still have 10.
That could be.
Not
is Benjamin,
that's an important
then
class.
Then is Benjamin... I don't want to leave... There's Point. Levi, Benjamin, Judah, and Simeon. I'm not... Most of Benjamin will follow... We're not going to go all that detail. So we'll discuss that some other time. Move forward here. Now, Yabesh Gilead, they were relatives of Saul, if you recall correctly. They're the ancestors of the rest of Benjamites, because when Benjamin went over and they killed the Levite's concubine, he cut him up and scattered her around the country. They all went to war. They killed all the women. They left like 200, I think, men left, something like that. Well, they took the women from Yabesh Gilead who didn't come to the battle and brought them down to Benjamin and said, here's your new wives. So they're relatives. This is not a foreign thing to go save your own son, because it really was. So Yabesh Gilead was, they're relatives for Saul and his family. For Kalkath, the Ehud was one of Saul's ancestors, if I recall correctly. I looked that up once and I've forgotten off the top of my head. Let's move forward here. The gory details. I'm not going to apologize for these men. These are who these men are. They're gory. And yeah, it's going to get a little bit worse in certain spots, too. That's just, nature of killers. They kill. So, Joab, he comes with, we don't know how many men he actually had with him. I don't think it lists the number of men that were actually with Joab, but commonly believed there weren't very many. He leaves the territory he brought and goes exploring. Now, where did he choose to go? He chose to cross the border up into northwestern portion of Jerusalem. It's a few miles northwest of Jerusalem, where this pool is located at. Now, is he crossing the border? It's all part of Israel. Is there really a defined border? This is the first real actual encounter of forces on one side and forces on the other side, and they actually fight. Up to this point, we're all relatives. We're all, brethren. We have no reason to fight one another. So he goes up there to this pool where Abner and his men happen to be coming down from Mahanaim and various other areas to the same pool. How big is this pool? I don't recall the exact size, but it's big enough. It's just barely big enough. But they could see and obviously talk across it. If I recall, somebody said it was about the size of, almost the size of a football field. It's a pretty good sized pool. I don't know if it was man-made or natural. That part I'm not sure about. Nobody told me that. So nobody recorded whether it was one way or the other. But a fairly good-sized pool. Common area to go water a whole bunch of men and troops. Hey, we need a dip. We need some water. Let's go into the pool. Good-sized pool. So that's where they went. Was this a chance encounter or a planned, one could argue one way or the other. But as I mentioned before, Joab is a young man, inexperienced and not very bright sometimes. I'd say that because he makes some really impetuous decisions, which cost him later on. His brothers, of course, equally impetuous decisions. I mean, they're young and new at this of power. They don't know what to do with power and control. David's a little bit more reserved and a little bit more knowledgeable about it. So they go along here, and Abner, of course, obviously they can talk across it, they can talk across the pool, or somehow get messengers, we don't really know the details. Abner suggested, and this happens, I want to point it out, in the morning, that they encounter each other at this pool. Because Bill's translation recorded something, the way he records it, with Joab talking to Abner, that is not actually correct. Because it misstates what Joab is actually telling Abner. So this happens in the morning. Abner says, let the young men duel. Had Abner not said anything, what would have happened? Nothing. They're all brethren. They may not like one another. They may have disagreements on political rules, what should and shouldn't happen. But there's no battle going on. They're not planning to kill one another. I mean, they didn't go out to conquer and destroy. That wasn't the purpose of this. So Abner suggests this, of course, since all he has is Benjamite men with him. They're all there. Now, in Abner's case, he has military men with him. These are men who are used to fighting in battles, in normal battles, I should say, very important, normal battles, where you have your side, your enemy has their side. You get your soldiers ready, they get their soldiers ready. Let's fight. What is Joab and David accustomed to? Well, David's accustomed to romping through the hillside and a defense and attack, but surprise attacks. David was known for, when he was dealing with Saul and controlling the army going in and out of the Philistines, of attacking when they weren't expecting it. He was very, very good at it. He would trap them, get them ensnared, and come in from the side, so to speak. It's very, what we would call a guerrilla warfare style. Now, does that mean Abner's men don't understand that? Well, no, not at all. Just that David's men are more familiar with it. They have used it all the time, and that's the only form of fighting that they're really familiar with over the last 2 to 3 years. Yes, Ellie.
David and his men have been being chased.
Yes, they have
the
been
whole
chased.
Time. These other guys were just running around trying to catch him. There's
right.
a difference.
There is a difference. One's the fighting for their life mentality, and the other one's fighting to conquer mentality. So you have a slight difference on their techniques of fighting. These 12 men, of course, 24 men, they all grab each other and kill each other at the same time, essentially, so they all drop down dead. Was that accomplish anything? No.
Yeah.
Well, what did it accomplish?
Starting a war.
Okay, yeah, it did start a war. I'll give it that. Yes, it did start a war. So it accomplished that, if that was the goal. maybe it was. I couldn't say for certain. Now, Abner's men and territory controlled, obviously, all of Benjamin, Ephraim, Manasseh, the Jezreel region, Yabesh-Gilead, and Asher. I want to point something out to you, which I meant to mention a few verses ago, which I forgot to. It says he made him king over Gilead. This is verse 9. Gilead, Jezreel, Ephraim, over Benjamin, over all of Israel. Why is Asher identified independent of the rest of Israel? Asherite, the descendants of Asher. Why are they independent? Why he didn't list Zebulun as independent. He didn't list Reuben. He didn't list Manasseh actually independent. What is going on with Asher that we should know about and recall and remember and keep in mind? Where is Asher? Up north, right? Who's next to Asher? Who's further north of Asher? Dan's not north. Dan's further east. Who's north of Asher? And what's Asher been doing for the past, 400 years? Growing trees. No such luck. No, he's not been growing trees. Same thing that Dan's been doing. Partly idol worship, more, I'm independent of you. Asher, much like Dan and the Phoenicians, had a different economy, different process, different people they dealt with, and different culture than the rest of Israel. Seamen, fishermen, merchants. These people, Asher and Dan and Phoenicians, had money. Because they would send their boats out as merchants, selling, buying, and bring them back. Were they involved in much of any of the battles that have ever taken place in the entire history of Israel from the time they crossed the Jordan and onward? A little bit while Joshua was around. Once they got their territory, catch you guys later. We got new land. We got new money. Sayonara. Asher was independent. Dan followed suit a few years later. Not very many. So the fact that Abner was able to say, okay, Ishbosheth, I'm going to bring Asher to follow you, what did Abner just do? He brought cash into Ishbosheth. Lots and lots of cash. Lots of money. How he did it? One could argue he was probably a very skilled power player. Diplomat. Yes, Ellie.
Those ships were going all the way to South America and getting gold during that period.
I don't know if that happened yet.
Okay,
that might be shortly.
Time of Solomon.
Right, right. So it's not quite yet, but that means they're investigating. Yeah, they're building and they're growing and they're dealing with Phoenicians. Which what's the problem with that though? When you deal with Phoenicians, what do they have?
They corrupt you.
They corrupt. So unfortunately, a lot of regions and territories in Asher, their names got changed to Phoenician names. Not the people, but actually the cities and the territories. They're actually not just Phoenician names, Phoenician months, names of the months. They're gods, the Phoenician gods. Asher renamed a few of them because they're merchants. If I say, I'm going to meet you in the month of Tishri, and you're from Greece... Tishri. What one's that? If I said, I'm going to meet you in the month of September, for example, I don't know where the word September comes from, but anyway, it just shows a month's name. Well, a foreign who named it after that same god, they're going to know exactly what that is. Oh yeah, I know that one. Okay, I'll meet you then. When Solomon's building the temple, he actually has to refer to certain months both ways. The fourth month, which is the name of this in Phoenician and the name of that in Hebrew, this happened. Why? Well, because he's getting all of his supplies, his money, and his tools, his trees, from Asher, Phoenicia, and Dan, brought back to build the temple. UPS delivery, yes. So, the fact that Abner brought Asher to follow Ishbosheth, Asher could have said, you know what? We were accustomed to being alone. We haven't obeyed a king. We didn't obey Saul. Why would we obey you? We're accustomed to having judges roam the territory. We're independent. That's how I kind of like how Texas is today, in some ways. We don't need you. They could have done that, but Abner was able to make them not do that. Said, no, you're king over them as well. Talented individual. So I want to point that out because it pops up later on. Not here, but in a few chapters from now. So as I mentioned, they go forth, they battle, they fight themselves out. The three sons of Zeruiah, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel, they're obviously very young individuals. Well, obviously, I believe they're very young individuals, probably in their 20s. So Asahel was swift on his feet. Verse 18, as they're pursuing Abner's men. Asahel pursues Abner in particular. Is he after Abner's men? No, he's after Abner. Abner in his probably 40s to 50s. Asahel probably in his 20s. Does Asahel fear Abner? Probably not so much. Maybe a little bit, but don't get me wrong, because he knows Abner's capabilities. Yeah, Abner outsmarted Asahel. Now, this is where I'm going to give a little bit of credit to Abner. You can disagree with me if you like. That's fine. Did Abner want to kill Asahel? No. What was Abner trying to do when he was saying, Asahel, is that you? Why don't you go grab a weapon, go this way, go anywhere else? What was he trying to do? Was he trying to humiliate Asahel? Oh, you're no match for me. Go pick on a peon soldier. I don't think so. Asahel, being swift on his feet, did he have any weapons with him? Probably had something. Was he intending to kill Abner? Maybe. Hard to say. Would it have been a disgrace to say, okay, Abner, I will leave? What are young men known for? Unabridged pride. Unabridged pride. Then I felt like, I will do this because I'm a man. Was it the right thing? Clearly in his case, no. It cost him his life. Now, I want to point this out. We think of the back of the spear that Abner used. Oh, well, was Abner intending to kill him? Yes. That's what you do with the back of the spears. Unlike, don't think about the back of a spear being dull. It's not. I used to think you have, the sharp end, the business end, and the unsharp end, the part where, it's just a piece of wood that's, shaved off, or maybe it's a little rounded, who knows. It's not. The back end is sharpened, just like the front end is. the blunt end. The reason is because the end which you shove in the ground when you set your spear down. You don't want to dull the sharp end. It's the other way. It's not sharp like a blade sharp. Sorry, don't be wrong. It's sharp end so it can go into the dirt. It's not like a knife. It's more like it's sharper than you'd think of. This is not like a shovel head at all. It's sharp enough to kill someone, obviously, and it has been used in this case to kill him. Yes, Bill.
Not to split hairs, but this is partly where the treachery comes in. It could be a shovel handle when you're running at great speed, and then all of a sudden
you hurl back.
He pretends treachery.
Uh-huh.
He pretends. Okay, I'm reading into it a little bit, Sharon. He pretends to be getting tired, increasing the confidence of his pursuer. He falls to the ground. Oh, by the way, the spear is already planted.
Uh-huh.
The guy keeps running. Then he exposes that.
Possibly.
At a good rate of speed, a pretty dull object will kill you.
That's true. It'll possible that's the case.
Yeah.
I didn't get the impression that Abner was intending to do that in the fashion of, okay, here, follow my spear, kind of thing. I didn't get that impression. I got my personal impression, because to travel through the person's body, is that Abner literally went, throw it right back into him. I'll say I was close enough to do that. Now, how fast they're running, I don't know. It's questionable. Asael being a much faster person than Abner, probably just your youthfulness, nothing else. It's possible it could be a treacherous thing, though. It could be a play that Abner was doing.
I just love to beat dead horses. But it's possible that, I didn't think about it, you just said it, that he wasn't intending to kill him. But because the weapon hit the ground, then the weight of the pursuer...
It can end up that way.
Tailed himself. Yeah.
Now, Abner's defense on this is that he said, how can I face your brother? I don't want to face your brother having killed you. In my opinion, Abner's intention all along was not to kill, necessarily. Now, whether Abner said fine and got a little angry and threw it back at him and then killed him, but so be it. But Joab and his brother end up treating this as a murder. Right. They always do that. There is no trial, of course. It's just immediate murder. Normally, a murder means you've killed somebody who is unarmed. Hence, maybe Abner's intentional law was, hey, Asael, arm yourself. I'm not going to fight you unarmed. And, of course, Asael refused, and Abner just killed him off. So it's a little bit a question of what they were doing or why they were doing it. We're trying to get a little bit into their heads, which is not easy to do, men who were dead a long time ago. But as far as what could be going on and what they were thinking. Now, Abner, later on, makes amends as best he can. His intention was not to cause this rift between himself and Dave. Because imagine, he knows Asael is David's nephew. He knows who this man is. This is not just an ordinary soldier. He doesn't want to do this because he's going to cause a war, a real war between him and David that's not repairable as far as Abner's concerned. So it's a risky thing that he just did. Yes, Sharon.
Well, you would think, this is a continuation of the battle that was very fierce, it says.
Right.
So you would think that Asael would have had some kind of weapon.
Most likely.
So he's probably running with something.
Something. What it was, we don't know. So was it a murder? Not likely. But that's how Joab felt that it was a murder. Yes, Ellie.
Well, besides Abner saying, how long is this going to go on? I think it sounds like Abner really... Okay,
doesn't want to be involved
with this.
Doesn't
want to go on any further with this. What was... And now let's figure out where we go from here.
Let's undo this.
It sounds like he wants to finish it, but these other guys are younger and saying,
they're impetuous.
Yay, let's
keep fighting.
Let's go fighting. Yeah.
Abner, I think, being an older man and knows who the real enemy is, which were the Philistines, not his fellow brethren, this was not a desirable outcome for him. It was going to end poorly. No matter what happened, it's going to end poorly. I move a little faster because I'm way over time, as always, but he ended late. It's all his fault. Pass the blame. So I'm looking to do that more. Okay, let's move forward here. So yeah, the end was most spears this time and age were slightly sharpened. I didn't mean to imply that they were sharp as a blade, but they're slightly sharpened because normally they're thrust to the ground when you're sitting there laying down, sleeping at night, whatever. You don't lay your spear down. Why don't you lay your spear down? What was that? Rust, the big thing. What's the other thing that the second that's not quite as important but does happen? You sleep down. you could hurt yourself on laying down spear. You can step on it. It can roll because spears are usually round, and you fall either on it or off the ground. But however, one stuck straight up, since spears are usually much taller than a human being is, you run into it and it doesn't actually hurt you. Ooh, there's a big stick like running into a tree. It could hurt you a little fast, but for the most part, it's not that bad. But that's usually how spears are usually stored, straight up and down. And as a result, you can also a whole bunch in one spot. And your soldiers, when they're grabbing the spear being attacked, they don't bend down to grab anything up. They grab it and run. There's no bending down, handing them out. You're running past, you grab a spear that's already stuck in the ground. It's very common at this time. No, we don't use spears today, but they're very common at their time. So the other end, the bottom, the blunt end is lightly sharpened so it can dig in the ground deep enough to hold its own weight up. Yoab, of course, and they continue on fighting or pursuing. But there's something that's very important that I want to point this out. Verse 26. As Abner, of course, all his men get together on this hill alongside Gia, and Joab's men finally catch up to them. Abner says, "Must a sword consume forever? Do you not know there will be a bitter ending to this?" I mean, this is not going to end well. Either my men will die, or your men will die, or one of us will probably die. That's not a good ending, because we're all brethren. "How long will you not tell the people to turn back after their brethren?" Joab responds, "As the Lord lives, had you not spoken..." This is my wording here. It was my text wording. I'll explain what they're saying in a minute. "As the Lord lives, had you not spoken first, already in the morning, every one of the people would have gone back from going after his brother." Joab, you blow the shofar, all people halted, no chase, went back. What's Joab saying to Abner? If you hadn't spoken first, if you had not spoken first this morning, if you had not challenged the duel this morning, all of the men would already have gone back from going after their brother. Abner, had you not challenged me this morning, this battle would never have happened. So Abner is saying, "Joab, return your people. Why aren't you being responsible?" Joab saying, "Abner, you're the irresponsible one. You challenged me." Throwing the blame right back at him. Were they both responsible? Yes. Should they both have known better? Yes. But their generals are throwing bad words at each other, essentially. Saying, "You're incompetent general, return your people. You incompetent general, you challenged me and you shouldn't have. We're brethren." So that's what they're battling back and forth. And that's what Joab is actually saying. That had you not mentioned something, spoken first already in the morning, you're not mentioned this morning, this wouldn't have happened already. We've already been gone back. We'd gone back to our homes. You'd go back to your homes. We wouldn't have this battle at all. The war between our peoples would never have occurred. Of course, it occurs and continues on for years as a result from this battle. They leave. Abner's men go home. Joab and his men go home. Joab loses 20 men total, including his brother. Abner's men lose 360. That's a lopsided battle. So who's more talented at guerrilla warfare? Joab's men. They're more accustomed to it. Not necessarily hand-to-hand combat. That may or may not be good. It doesn't matter. Guerrilla warfare are tactics. David's men are more talented. And of course, this continues on. The war between both houses will go on for a few years. And David continues to gains in strength. In Chronicles, it records the number of tribes that start following David during this time. You know, so many thousands of this tribe go and say, "Okay, David, we're on your side." So many thousands of this tribe, "We're David, we're on your side." This happens in a matter of a few months. These tribes are starting to defect from Ishbosheth. That's why I say, "You are not our king. You are not the one responsible. You're not the one who should be here." Abner, of course, well, we'll discuss his fate in a couple of chapters. What I want to say here. Did David want any of this outcome? Does our Messiah want this type of an outcome? To where his people are divided, they fight back and forth, bickering and killing one another if they so desire. It's not the desire of our God or our Messiah for this outcome. It is. Division doesn't work well. Although God's the one who divides. Don't get wrong.
For a purpose.
For a purpose.
Yeah.
In this particular purpose, God divided them up.
Yeah.
But it was through Abner and how this was battling out that these divisions were, lines were being drawn. But God clearly was blessing the side he chose. This is the side that must be united. Or Messiah is supposed to do the same thing. When the, as we discussed earlier today, the bloody Messiah, so to speak, is coming back. Who's he coming after first? His own. So is this symbolic? Yeah, it is.
It's like David,
it is symbolic.
It took a while. First had Judah. Then it took a while to get the rest of Israel.
It is.
I think the very same thing is going to take place when the Messiah comes. He's going to get Judah first, and then he's going to have to go after the rest of them.
He's going to convince the rest of them, you follow me.
Go follow me now.
Your life.
It's not going to be an overnight trick.
Yeah, yeah. The life that you're following, the leaders you're following are failing. They're dropping down. Can you not see and have them, as it shows, records in Chronicles, they're defecting. Say, oh, you're right. You are the one I should be following. So it is symbolic because it's actually supposed to be in our future that this Messiah is supposed to reunite the kingdoms under, the tribes under. And that's how he's supposed to do it. Go after his own tribe first. I apologize for taking you way over time, but oh well. Have a wonderful rest of Shabbat.